control of magistrates were in a position to make a detached and neutral decision. And based on what Mr. Shepherd indicated previously and my own experience, I haven't seen cases where we have the fast-breaking sort of situation that he talks about. Generally, the kinds of cases that involve body wires are cases where they are developing a person over a period of time. They're trying to do a series of sales or buys with the person in order to get the type of evidence that they need to present in court. So it's not very often that you have the sort of fast-breaking situation that he claims is necessary for the police officer to make a decision on his or her own. And I submit that in that kind of situation, that's when you have the sort of escape clause for exigent circumstances. In our state, we're real careful under the Constitution to make sure that someone other than the police officer makes a decision about whether an action is justified. And to take that away and give it to the police officer would put them in a decision-making position and give them discretion that they're not entitled to have. They may not have the expertise to utilize, and it's going to be to the detriment of the public at large. One of the concerns that came to my mind during Mr. Shepherd's discussion about the sort of entrapment idea and having an exact record with the tape recording is it remains a possibility that if there are tape recordings done, number one, in the police officer's discretion, they may be selective. In other words, things that don't seem good for the state wouldn't be recorded. And number two, if all conversations are recorded, the ones that may not be beneficial for the state may disappear or not be turned in by that police officer. So there is no provision to ensure that a defendant would be apprised that conversations were recorded, unless there is the court order involved, which becomes part of the court record. So that is of direct concern. Additionally, if there becomes a situation that is fast-breaking, so to speak, and an officer wants to try to use a body wire, there are provisions under our state laws for telephonic search warrants. There is usually in every county a district attorney on call to assist a police officer. So they have avenues to try to obtain the court order if, in fact, they have the situation that they're not sure is a real exigency, but which requires them to get some expert advice. So I submit that right now we have an adequate statute. We have the court running interference, so to speak, between the police officer and the public, and that to take that away, even in the situation of drug cases, is going to cause way more problems than it's going to solve. And that's all I have at this time.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Brennerman.
Well, you think then it's likely that police officers are going to be using this to fabricate cases?
Sir, I don't mean to disparage police officers. I merely voice a concern that if there is a very good case, but which has some recordings that are not a benefit, that those recordings may somehow disappear a la the 15 minutes or whatever it was in the Watergate case. And that is a concern that I do have.
But if they observe what they believe to be some drug sale situation going on, you think it's practical to go make a phone call and get a telephonic search warrant or telephonic court authorization to put on a tap on that kind of body wire on that kind of situation?
Well, as I understand the body wire situation, you'd have to put it on the person. So if a hand-to-hand sale is going down, for example, I doubt the officer is going to have time to put on a body wire anyway. But that's where the officer has to make a decision whether he or she wants to consider that exigent circumstances if they want to effect an arrest at that time, or whether it's an ongoing investigation, as most of the cases I see are, and then perhaps rely on his or her memory of that situation, try to get another buy set up. That leaves time to go get the court order and continue the investigation. So I doubt that situation is going to come up, is what I'm saying.
Senator Grinsky.
Your concerns about the missing 15 minutes or whatever would still lead the police officer open to cross-examination. I assume that the defendant would tell his lawyer that, hey, that's not everything that I said. I also said this or that, and which would require the police officer to lie under oath. And although I've seen police officers exaggerate, very rarely do they actually lie. And so if there was something really incriminating on there, you could always get into that. I suppose the defendant could also wear his own body wire so that they could record what was going on and have their own source of information. I don't think your concerns are all that worthy, really. I appreciate it could theoretically happen, but I don't think it's a real problem versus the balancing of what you need to do there.
Well, if I could respond, maybe let me back it up for a minute. I don't mean to get everybody mad at me because I sound like I'm impugning police officers, because that's not what I mean to do. The way that the amendment is written is a conversation between the officer or someone under the officer's supervision. And as I understand it, the Senate took out the requirement of it being direct supervision. So that means you can have a situation where a cooperating individual, is actually the one with the body wire on. And that individual is going to be the one who's going to be turning over body wire tapes to the police officer. So that individual may be the one who's making the decision as to what conversations get recorded or what conversations get turned over to the police officer. And with the cooperating individuals that often are involved in cases, they are themselves criminally involved. They want to provide the best possible assistance to a police officer. And in my experience, a lot of times those people have no compunction about lying. So I think that the concern is not maybe directly with police officers, but with the type of persons that they necessarily employ. So my position is the better way to handle it is to leave it with the magistrate making the decision and with having a record of, in fact, what conversations are then recorded.
I'm sure.
Senator Hill.
Just follow up on that. Excuse me, but unless the magistrate is there, how does the magistrate know what was or was not said or recorded? You're losing me a little bit there.
If we have a court order to allow body wire recordings, for example, I had a case out of Marion County that was in federal court in Eugene where it was an ongoing investigation of some cocaine dealers. There were several conversations recorded. There was an order from a Marion County Circuit Court judge. When I got discovery, evidence reports, that sort of thing in the case, I saw that there was, in fact, this body wire order. Having that knowledge, I was able to go to the prosecutor and say, I want to see this evidence. I want to be able to evaluate it. And in my experience, that's very important in evaluating your case. But
they could doctor it before they turned it over to the prosecutor as well, couldn't they, if they were going to do something like that?
Sure. I mean, that can happen, obviously. But if you have a situation where there is a court record that body wire interceptions have been permitted, it lets everybody know that that's a facet of the case, and it can be analyzed that way. As the bill is written with an officer making the decision as to recordings, then there is only the officer's record or this individual, the cooperating individual's record. If, for example, if somebody went to an officer and said, look, I think that so-and-so is about to commit, is about to manufacture methamphetamine, and the officer says, okay, go ahead and record it, because they say they're going to do the manufacture right now, and then say it doesn't turn out that they're manufacturing at all. That conversation may then be erased as not important, and it would never go to the defense when it might actually be helpful information for the defendant's case. I got kind of convoluted there.
Okay,
sense?
We've got a lot of other people have testified. We have more questions?
Well, just one. I guess the entrapment situation. If that's the defense that's used fairly often, couldn't that help a defendant to know, to prove that he or she was entrapped if there is a the more of these that are recorded, the more you would be able to know whether they were entrapped or not.
Could
be. You don't know they're taking place. You would never know.
I have a question, but I think I need to ask somebody, further witnesses, about reporting this after the fact, so that you would, in fact, have some entry to know that it's been done, so that you would then know enough to request. You know, otherwise you would never know.
And just one final thing, Madam Chair, and I'll...
Well, take your time.
Is with the drugs now, I mean, this is a very... Aren't the exigent circumstances, aren't the circumstances involving drug crimes really different than other situations? I mean, that drug crimes, given how they occur, doesn't this make the circumstances a bit more exigent than you might find in other cases?
I'd like to agree with you, but I must disagree. Usually drug cases, at least the ones that I handle, and I handle a lot of them, tend to be ongoing. If it's manufactured methamphetamine, they have to get a hold of the chemicals. They have to get a hold of things. So it's something that the police build
up.
We're
talking about drug dealing, I mean, let's be specific. I mean,
okay,
that may or may not be ongoing. I'm talking about a situation here, say, for example, in Salem, where we had a big problem with people just dealing drugs out on the streets in neighborhoods. Okay, now, I'm not really that interested in an ongoing thing necessarily. I understand what you say about those, but what about those kinds of situations? There may be some times where you want to get one person at that time, at that moment, and it not be an ongoing thing. And it seems as though that situation here in Salem was just completely out of hand. And if it would have seemed to me, and I listened to, maybe you can tell me I'm wrong, but that of having a body wire in some of those cases would have been helpful. It's because I see the problem is not just one that's an ongoing. Sometimes it's one of trying to get, it could be a one-time situation, one transaction situation.
You're talking about like on the corner of, I don't know, 6th and
sure.
Main, it's a real problem, that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Okay. My response to that would be, in that case, I think that the statute has provisions where the officer could go to a judge and say, look, we've got a real documented problem on 6th and Main. I want to go down there with the body wire and hang out and see what I can do. And then the judge is still in a position to make the decision.
Hang out? I mean, don't you have to have, some specificity in a warrant, don't you?
Well,
I mean,
if you've got the documentation, like there's been 8 cases in the past 6 months where there's been drug sales on that corner, or the officer can say, I've made observations over a period of 3 weeks and seen 8 sales. I think that's sufficient for the judge to authorize the body wire.
But what about the situation where I'm in an area, I see something happen, and I happen to have a body wire with me, and I just want to go over there and get some evidence? I mean, what's wrong with that? I mean, what is wrong with that situation?
We don't allow that under our Constitution. I mean, we allow, like, by telephone, but the face-to-face recording, there's got to be consent. I mean, the right to privacy is tantamount. That's the only way I can answer it.
Thank you.
Steve?
Steve Anderson, appearing also on behalf of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Madam Chairman, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Mr. Shepard referred to the case of State versus Lissy, which is 304 or Oregon 455. And the first point I want to make about that case is that it notes that the legislature itself has reviewed this distinction that he described as anomalous between telephone recordings and face-to-face recordings many times since it was first put into effect some years ago, and in each case has not changed it. And so that I think the rationale between the expectation of privacy that a common understanding between telephone conversations and direct face-to-face conversations is clear. There is a distinction, And the simplest way that I can think of to put it, and I'm trying to dovetail with what Senator Springer said, is that on the telephone, you can't tell if anyone else is there or not, or anyone else is listening. But in a face-to-face conversation, it's obvious whether there's a third person or a fourth person or anyone else near you. And you can modify your communication accordingly. If you don't want other people to hear, you simply don't make the communication. But on the phone, if there's other people listening in, there's no way for you to know that. And so my experience, both in my law practice and in general, is that there are many, many times when face-to-face communications take precedence over telephone communications, and that there are many things you simply find uncomfortable, uneasy, inappropriate to engage in over the phone, and I think that's the reason. Although I searched in the case law, I searched past in the history of LISI, and I couldn't find it stated as such. I would also echo the, although I have less experience in this area, it seems to me that most of the time we're in a situation of controlled buys, so-called controlled buys, where there is some prior arrangement between the suspect and the authorities. And so it's not all that spontaneous. And if these situations are always dangerous, and to some degree I would concede they are inherently dangerous, then perhaps in every instance there should be an application for an order. Now, these two, this bill and 2191 overlap somewhat, and I don't want to blur them, but I did want to present some of the facts in the case of State versus Pottle, which was at 296 Oregon 274, because I think that case is a great illustration of problems that can arise when there's no order. And I think what it is fundamentally based on is a concern for the right to privacy, firstly, and secondly, a concern about the granting of a great deal of government power in a very broad sense. The Pottle case was a murder case, and in that case, Christopher Tucker died. His wife, Mindy Tucker, and a friend, Craig Pottle, were suspects. And the suspicion on the part of the police was that this ex-wife and boyfriend were going to collect the insurance policy benefits. With that information, the police went to the court and asked for an ex parte order, and did a tap of Mindy, the phone of the residence at which Mindy Tucker was living, for 2 months, a phone tap. And 958 phone calls were recorded, and only 15 concerned communications between Pottle and Tucker, the actual suspects. The court held that this, the ex parte order, was defective and suppressed the evidence because it lacked specificity, it lacked a cutoff date, a termination date, and it lacked a duration directive. In other words, it lacked any specified instance of what exactly are you looking for in this tap, and if you find it, are you going to stop? And I want to read to you a few excerpts from Pottle to get in the record, because there really is an analogy between the ex parte order and a search warrant, and so we don't want to reduce the importance of an order. It should be given the same kind of attention that a search warrant is given. At page 284, the court, this is Justice Campbell, quotes from the recognized treatise in this area by Mr. Carr, The Law of Electronic Surveillance, where it says, "The order serves the same function as a conventional search warrant by indicating judicial authority for the search." The court then refers to ORS 133-7245, which is referred to as a minimization provision, and it says, every order and extension thereof shall contain a provision that the authorization to intercept shall be executed as soon as practicable, shall be conducted in such a way as to minimize the interception of communications not otherwise subject to interception, and must terminate upon attainment of the authorized objective or in any event in 30 days. And quoting a little further down the page, the application must provide probable cause for the order to issue. And then in discussing this concept of minimization, the court says, the constitutional principle that all invasions of privacy must be limited in scope to the minimal intrusion necessary to fulfill their purpose is related to minimization with particular reference to problems of duration and termination. And in effect, what the court found was that the police in this instance, at the direction of the district attorney, recorded vastly more calls than they needed to and gathered an enormous amount of evidence that had nothing to do with the case. It had nothing to do with what they were driving at. And the analogy is to the particularity requirement in a search warrant case. And the court said at 287, because of the inherent dangers of abuse in the wiretap process, we hold that Oregon courts must require strict compliance with all statutory requirements leading to the issuance of a wiretap order. In the present instance, we are dealing with a search and seizure process that is inherently more intrusive than the traditional search and seizure. This statutory scheme shows two concerns: the authorization of a powerful tool to be used in criminal investigations and the protection of individual privacy. Our court system must carry out the legislature's concern for privacy as much as the aim of law enforcement. I suppose I could read further. I'll just quote two more times. On page 288, the court said, a wiretap order may not allow carte blanche surveillance any more than a search warrant may allow a general search. And finally, at 290, the court said, we think strict adherence to this statute is the correct standard to govern district attorneys in drafting affidavits and orders, and judges in scrutinizing such orders before authorizing a wiretap. So I think that gives you a flavor, this is an 84 case, of how strongly the Supreme Court of Oregon feels about ex parte orders. They look at them extremely closely. And if you enact this provision as it's written, you will be proceeding along a very different path, I believe. You will be granting an enormous amount of discretion to officers in the field who sometimes don't have all that time to reflect. In closing, I don't know exactly. Our first position in OCDLA is that we oppose the bill flatly, and we urge you not to pass it. However, I believe there is one way, if you are disposed towards the bill in any degree, that you could improve it substantially, and that would be, in terms of a conceptual amendment, words to the effect that within 24 hours of one exercise obtaining of a conversation in this manner without an ex parte order, that if it's contemplated the same thing is going to be done again with the same parties or in the same place, that within 24 hours of the first time, the officials be required to go to the court and get an ex parte order. Because without that kind of protection, you end up having a statute that grants a continuous kind of authority that could proceed over a very long period of time, which, if it were done by an order, would be found invalid. And it just seems a mistake to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thanks very much. Dale Pan, oh, actually, Rob Olson.
Good
How often would the city of Eugene use this?
Well, I can give you some examples, Madam Chair. First of all, my name is Rob Olson. I'm a detective with the Eugene Police Department and worked narcotics investigations for about 6.5 years under both systems. I worked under the system prior to the amended version, which is currently in effect, where you need a court order. We didn't used to need a court order to work narcotics investigations. There was, to my knowledge, no abuse of it, and we used the body wire virtually all of the time. Now the use of the body wire has dropped dramatically, and contrary to what Ms. McRae indicated to the court, the vast majority of narcotics investigations are in fact those fast-moving investigations where it is very difficult to know all of the particulars going into it and put into detail the necessity for a court order. The usage of the body wire has dropped tremendously.
How much did you use it before that?
I would say we used it about 90% of the time.
No, no. How many times a week? How many times a month?
Oh.
How much are you...
It depends on whether or not you're doing street-level drug investigations or long-term conspiracy-type investigations, and that ebbs and flows.
How many officers and how time do you use it? Just tell, you know, I need to get a sense of what we're talking about here.
It was virtually used all of the time. And
so every time you sent out an officer in the vice, they had a body wire on?
In a drug case. Virtually all of the time.
That was, what were the years?
I believe the change was made 2 years ago, perhaps four years ago, something like that. I worked narcotics from 78 until 85 with one intermittence there. So during that time, most of that time period, it was allowable to use the body wire without a court order. And I think it's important to note that you still had judicial review because before any of this got into court, the court still had to determine that you used the body wire for the purposes of a narcotics investigation, which is exactly what the court's being asked to decide in advance anyway. A couple of other points. First of all, I certainly don't mean to impugn the integrity of defense attorneys, but when defense attorneys sit here and tell you that their intent is that they be allowed to get all of those tapes into court, don't you believe it? What their hope is that the tapes will not make it into court because they are the best evidence of what is happening in the real world. Body wires, in my point of view, are certainly a necessity for officer safety. Certainly what Senator...
So every vice, how many vice do you have in the city of Eugene?
How many officers?
Vice officers, yeah.
I'd prefer not to indicate that. It's our policy not to make public information about the number of officers that we have working in that area investigation. But it's a relatively small number. But we also use it. Well, let me back
maybe
up for just a
maybe you could contract with the Housing Authority in Portland.
Maybe they are.
I'm wondering.
We have less than we need. Let's put it that way. In regards to what Senator Springer indicated earlier about the concerns of wearing a body wire, those absolutely exist. You are concerned when you put one on. But let me give you an example. The first time I ever worked an undercover case and went in and bought cocaine, I was wearing a body wire, and when I was inside the residence, I stood too close to an old TV that had rabbit ear antennas, and the TV started to squeal, and you can bet I started backing up. And fortunately, somebody in the residence that lived there indicated that it was just a reception problem with the TV, but the sweat was pouring. But at the same time, I was also very thankful that I had that body wire on because the officers that were following me in one of these fast-moving investigations, we did not know where I was going to be going. And in fact, it was at night, and the residence that I was going to was very dark, and in fact, it was a multi-level residence, and I entered in through a side door, which I was able to describe to the officers on the body wire, via the body wire, before I made entry into the residence. Without that capability, they would not have known where I was, and my safety would have been jeopardized. We had another instance in a tavern situation where.
So you wouldn't you would not have taken. You don't think it's worthwhile enough to go to a judge to say right now I'm going out on this kind of case. It's not worth it to you to have a body wire with you under that circumstances.
No, the problem, Senator, is that it is a time problem. We have certainly gone to the court and we've gotten court orders. We have also gone out under exigent circumstances, which we believe to be exigent circumstances, and gone out without the court order. The problem is that there are a large number of cases that fall in that gray area in between, and it's up to an interpretation where you've got an hour before this deal's going to go down. How do you best utilize your time? Do you do it in briefing the officers and getting all of the components put together for the deal, or do you use your time sitting at a computer terminal, typing up the final analysis, tracking down the judge, trying to get the information signed in that capacity? And in that way, it is not worth it to us in those kinds of cases to use our time to have a judge tell us that, yes, it is a narcotics case that you're going to go work, and therefore you may use a body wire. The other problem with the court order situation is that besides the fact that it's time-consuming and that there are a number of gray areas in between, is that the court wants to hear particulars about who your target is, what the location is, and the period of time that's going to be investigated. And those are questions that are frequently unanswerable going into an investigation and going in and telling them that I don't know, but I still need it because it's the kind of situation that was described before, does nothing, in my view, for the court to make an educated decision more so than we're making going into it.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Hill.
Oh. Yeah, go ahead.
Senator Schumacher.
I perhaps should have asked this earlier, but I've noted that
investigations. And this is obviously utilized in the conspiracy kinds of cases, the cases where you're trying to identify and prosecute the person who's financing the narcotics rather than the bottom line street dealers and users and those types of people. Other than that, there is no change. It's the same statutory procedure as under federal law. It requires a sworn affidavit by the district attorney for the county. A police officer may not apply for a wiretap. It requires very specific requirements, and this is the type of situation that the Pottle case dealt with, was the court finding that there wasn't enough detail in the affidavit that was provided, and just a holding that there must be strict compliance with it. I would add that it requires particularization of who, when, where. There's a requirement that only conversations that would be relevant to the investigation be recorded. This is the doctrine of minimization, which the Pottle case deals with also. These are all clear requirements under the statute. It requires that once a year I furnish a report to the Federal Department of Justice specifying how many wiretaps have taken place in my county, what they were for, what the results were. So this bill simply gives law enforcement a tool in the conspiracy, major distribution kinds of cases to allow you to gather evidence on the financiers of major narcotics transportations and dealings, and it brings us in line with federal law by allowing wiretaps for major narcotics investigations.
Thank you, Dale. Other questions? Senator Schumacher.
Yeah. Dale, did you say that 2191 and 2252 have been kind of put our companion bills?
Madam Chair and Senator Schumacher, I was referring to the fact that one of the witnesses had used the Pottle case greatly in talking about 2252. And body wires in the Pottle case do not go together.
Okay.
Wiretaps in the Pottle case go together, and there's a much more stringent standard, a very detailed type of affidavit for a wiretap. It must be done by a district attorney, not by a police officer. There are much higher standards for that kind of evidence, and that's what wiretap and 2191 and Pottle are all about.
I noticed two different ways of wording provisions in both bills that one would think would be worded the same, and I'm wondering if there's a reason for this, and it may be that it just happened that different people drafted it. House Bill 2191 adds the language, or a crime punishable as a felony under ORS 475.992 or 475.995. And those are the two statutes that actually list some felonies. and it uses the phrase, or a crime punishable as a felony. Whereas in 2252, the language is about to commit a felony, provided the felony is one defined in ORS 475.991-2, 475.995. And I just wonder if there's any significance to the different way that those two references to the felony statutes are made.
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, I believe I did not draft 2191. However, I could say that 2252 is a more inclusive bill and pertains to more types of crimes, narcotics crimes. I think 2191 has been confined to the manufacturing, delivery, and delivery to minors situation, and that's why they've specified two statutes out of there. 2252, the body wire, deals with any felony narcotics crime. And so that can be possessions and manufacturers, delivery to minors. It can be delivery of counterfeit substances. There are other crimes listed there, but they all have to be felony controlled substances crimes for the body wire. It's more restrictive for a wiretap.
Maybe Jack could just sort of ponder that a little bit and see if it's meaningful. I don't know.
It's a policy question, Senator.
Yeah.
I think I would be useful if all the committee members pondered it and looked over those statutes, because I think if you look, I think what he just said is that 2191 is more restricted and 2252 allows use of body wires in a broader context.
2252, some of the statutes between 991 and 995 relate only to misdemeanors, not to felonies at all.
Right.
So you wonder why 991, which relates only to misdemeanors, is included in 2252.
Probably not right.
And then on 2199 uses the phrase, or a crime punishable as a felony, rather than simply says a felony.
Well, I think you've got different people making judgments. You got a DA who's making it on 2191, who knows, who's supposed to have some bigger judgments about what kind of cases they're into for a wiretap, mm-hmm. and I think that's, they're looking at a much looser determination for the police officers, and I'm not arguing, I think that's why it is. I think it's a policy decision for this committee of whether we want to open it up for police officers in that broad range.
Okay, well, I don't want to dwell on it. I just was troubled by the difference in wording and wondered if it was significant.
I think it is. Senator Brockman.
Madam Chair, I have a question. Thank you. Is there a history to this bill? Has it been around before?
Madam Chair and Senator Brockman, 2191, to my recollection, and that's really the last three sessions that I've been working on bills for the DA's Association, I don't recall this coming up before. When the federal statute was originally adopted in Oregon, narcotics were excluded from wiretaps. They basically adopted the federal statute in Oregon, except for narcotics. Narcotics has become such a major problem in the last few years, that was the reason or the impetus to bring this vehicle forward to say we need to have that kind of investigative tool to deal with the people who finance narcotics.
I don't think this has been, I've never.
No, I just wondered why not. That's
well, because we conformed it to the federal statute and they changed.
Yeah.
Thank you. Dennis O'Donnell and Robert Jackson. And then next we'll call Steve Anderson and Sean McRae. Sean maybe had the issue background again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, again, I'm Robert Jackson, the coordinator of criminal justice for Governor's Office. I'm here to express the Governor's support of House Bill 2191 and once again make myself available for any questions that the Chair or the committee might have.
And Lieutenant Dennis O'Donnell with the Oregon State Police Narcotics Unit. Senator Cohen and committee members, basically what we're asking to be able to do here is do something that we're already doing in Oregon. At present time, we're involved in interagency task forces, these type of situations throughout the state where we're working with federal agencies on narcotics investigations that wiretaps are being obtained on. And what we would like to be able to do is be able to utilize this within the state of Oregon without having to go through a federal agency, without having someone maybe in Washington, D.C. deciding whether or not we here in Oregon ought to be conducting a wiretap investigation. And that's basically the bill. I'd be more than glad to answer any questions.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Steve Anderson.
Steve Anderson again with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. Ms. McGray had to leave. I would be tempted to defend myself with respect to my previous testimony about Pottle. I'll just say that, which is probably obvious, I was trying to make a general point as to the validity and the importance of orders. I wasn't making a literal translation. But I do think there's a relationship between these two bills, 2191 and the other one. The only thing I wanted to say was that in putting in these drug crimes under ORS 475.992 and 475.995, I could envision, I wish that could, that language could be tightened up a little bit, because I could envision a so-called confidential reliable informant saying, I saw cocaine in Joe Blow's car, and I guess I wonder whether is that enough to then put a wiretap on this person. In other words, I think the language is committing, has committed, is about to commit, works better for the existing crimes that are listed in the statute. But when you include drug crimes, I think it's vague, and I think it's a real catch-all. And I can't offer you anything in the way of a specific amendment at this time to make it a little narrower, to rein it in a little, but I would think that that should be a concern.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Wicker.
Is there any difference between reasonable grounds to believe and probable cause to believe?
There's a lot of case law that blurs those two distinctions. And I think, in my mind, probable cause connotes a higher degree of belief than reason. Usually it's the distinction is reasonable suspicion and probable cause.
This statute, as it's now in the books, requires only reasonable grounds to believe in order to get your order.
Yes, Senator.
And I'm just wondering if that's appropriate, or whether if we were going to go with this, we ought to impose a more exacting standard, probable cause to believe.
That would be, in my mind, that would be preferable language. Probable cause would be preferable language.
Any other comments? Thank you very much. Okay, I'd like to ask Rosanna to wait just a second, and then I want to get at least the proponents of the other bill on before we lose. Then we'll get you back for the record. Pete Shepherd, House Bill 2469. And why don't you get, let's get, I guess Dale Penn, you may as well come up too. But if you get started, Pete, please. It's a bit different. I want to make sure that we get,
I'll be as brief as I can, Senator. My name is Pete Shepherd. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill, A. Engrossed House Bill 2469. The bill does four basic things, divided into four sections. The first section is first group of sections. Sections 1 to 5 of the bill are a response to a relatively recent opinion of the Oregon Supreme Court entitled State versus Campbell. And in State versus Campbell, what the police did was attach a radio transmitter, a mobile radio transmitter, sometimes called a bird dog, with the use of a magnet to the bottom of a suspected burglar's car. And then they monitored where that car went by the use of an airplane to follow where he went. And in fact, they followed him and arrested him in the course of a burglary. He objected to the use of that evidence because the police did not obtain a search warrant before monitoring the emissions from that radio transmitter. And the police didn't think they needed one because they followed this gentleman over public highways, and as they pointed out, they could have driven along right behind him and obtained the same information, or at least if they'd been secretive enough about it, they could have. In any event, the Oregon Supreme Court determined that the Oregon Constitution requires police officers to obtain a search warrant under those circumstances. This committee can't change that result, and this bill does not ask the committee to change that result. What this bill does do is ask the committee to accommodate the mechanics of executing a search warrant under those circumstances, because the existing search warrant statutes require things that are inconsistent with the use of such investigative tools. For example, the existing search warrant statute would require the police officers to serve on Mr. Campbell a notice that they were monitoring in the course of executing a search, because the statute requires that the police officer, before executing a search warrant, serve a copy of the warrant on the person who's being searched. Obviously, that could not be done under the circumstances of State versus Campbell. So what Sections 1 to 5 of the bill do is create a procedural mechanism by which the procedures of executing a search warrant are reconciled with the requirement that we obtain one under these circumstances. The next section of the bill, Sections 6 to 13 of the bill, conform Oregon law to an enactment of the United States Congress as of approximately two and a half years ago. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986 created a new category of protected communications, and that category of communications is entitled electronic communications. Included in the category of electronic communications are transmissions that have become increasingly an integral part of sophisticated narcotics distribution mechanisms. And those are transmissions to the little display pagers that we're all familiar with. And the way the drug dealer uses those, of course, is to stay in contact with his or her customers. And indeed, we find these are very common tools for narcotics dealers. Under the federal act, those communications from the paging company to the drug dealer's pager may not be intercepted without an order that's the equivalent of a wiretap order. And indeed, the federal act says that no state judge may issue such an order unless the law of that state specifically allows the interception of electronic communications. Now, the effect of that has been, as of October of 1988, the effective date of the federal act, that Oregon law enforcement officers cannot use the practice of obtaining a duplicate pager tuned to the same frequency as a narcotics dealer in order to assist in developing the case against that narcotics dealer. So that what in part sections 6 to 13 of the bill do is permit the interception of such communications. And in addition to that, section 7, lines 18 and 19, permit the interception of electronic communications in narcotics cases. And the effect of that change in Oregon law will be the same as you have just heard described with respect to House Bill 2191. And that is that section 7, lines 18 and 19, would authorize the issuance of a wiretap order in Oregon for narcotics cases. The third thing that House Bill 2469 does is described in Section 14, and again, it conforms the Oregon law to the law in the federal system, and that is that cordless telephone transmissions are not protected under the federal law by the wiretap requirements. And what Section 14 of the bill does is say that we're going to adopt the same rule in Oregon. Presently, the interception of such communications is not only produces evidence that you can't use in a prosecution, but it's also a crime. And the last thing that the bill does is in sections 15 to 24, and here again, this is a response to the federal law. In recent years, police officers have learned that the use of trap and trace devices, which are devices which identify telephone numbers which dial into a targeted telephone, and the use of pen register devices, which are devices that dial out from that targeted telephone, that those devices are very helpful in sophisticated narcotics investigations. What those devices do is generate a list of the telephone numbers dialed into or out of a targeted telephone. They do not give the police officer or anyone else access to the content of the communication. They are not a wiretap. They simply generate a list of telephone numbers. Now, the federal law provides that no state judge may issue such an order authorizing the interception, the use of such devices, unless the state law authorizes the a judge of that state to do so. And in fact, Oregon has no such provision. So again, we're in the situation since October of 1988 where Oregon police officers cannot use trap and trace or pen register devices, but their federal brethren and sistren, law enforcement officers, may do so. Again, that's deprived Oregon narcotics enforcement officers of...
Okay, come and stop you. This doesn't deal just with narcotics, though. It's broad range.
No, that's correct. That is correct. I'm using narcotics...
So let's not talk about narcotics. We're talking about lots and lots and lots of other things here.
Madam Chair, actually, I think I use narcotics advisedly, not with any intent to mislead the committee, of course, but the fact is those are the cases where these devices will be used. And the reason is that...
Well, why don't we limit that then? Let's do that in the bill.
Madam Chair, that is an option the committee has. It would not violate the federal statute. It would give Oregon a rule, again, that's different than the federal law.
Right. And we might wish to do that.
Maybe. And I'm indicating to the committee that that's an option the committee has. There are other kinds of cases where these devices might be of utility. For example, a gambling case, these devices might be useful. Or a racketeering case based on a system of fraud. These devices might be useful. But certainly it is true that their principal utility will be in the narcotics field.
Thank you.
That's all I have for the committee then. I'd stand open for questions.
Okay. Sir Hill.
Yes, so one of the devices that you talked about that will record the incoming calls and the outgoing calls, how do you use that to get a specific number, or
Madam Chair,
I guess the thing is anyone who calls that person, is that, but because I can understand that, for example, in the drug house cases, and when you see somebody pull up in front of the drug house and people write down the license plates of the people, well, you know if they're going in there. I shouldn't say you know that they're going to be going in. If it is a drug house, they're going to be going in there, so it's just not an ordinary residence. But now you're talking about anyone who calls somebody. So tell me, how do you use that?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, it is correct that the device doesn't have any, because it doesn't have access to the content of the communication, it has no way of discriminating between a drug-related call, for example, and a non-drug-related call. What one does, though, with these devices is generate a pattern over a period of some weeks or months. And it's striking how quickly one can understand the connections between sophisticated narcotics distributors and sellers. If you know that there is one particular call that is always called within a half hour of the time that your informant makes contact with the drug dealer, for example, and one would only know that through the use of a trap and trace device. Likewise, if one knows from a pen register device that there are telephone calls that come in 20 times a day from a particular telephone number to the suspected drug dealer's number, it is a great aid in constructing a theory about who it is who's calling that person. And
it's been interesting. I'm going to interrupt you because I've had occasion to have one of have my telephone searched in the same way and have it reported in the paper. It's been a very interesting experience as an individual, a private individual.
Madam Chair, these devices are in use now. They're in use largely by telephone companies to assist people like my parents who had harassing telephone calls coming in. So they certainly do have utility even now. I would say putting it in the newspaper is not appropriate.
But it's not illegal, and people do it.
That would not change, of course, under 2469 would not change that result, unfortunately.
Right.
Are there copies of that in our file?
Madam Chair, you piqued my curiosity. Could you tell me what you mean by somebody, how it got in the papers? Or what?
Well, I'll show you the letter.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shoemaker.
In some respects, this bill is like 2191, particularly in its amendment of ORS 133.724. Yet I note that under this bill, 2469, you could intercept for any crime arising under 475.992, including misdemeanors, whereas under 2191, it's limited to felonies under 992.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, that's correct. The bill, as I said, does authorize interception in the same felony cases and others as well, and it flows from that the drafting difference that you've described. That is just an artifact of the fact that different people drafted these bills. I worked on 2469 and was not involved in 2191.
Well, you must have intended that you'd be able to bug telephones and other communications to pick up such things as Class C misdemeanors, then.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, that is the draft of
that's what you intended
2469, and that is what I intended and what the bill would accomplish.
Okay, and then do I also understand what is a private land mobile communication system? Car phone?
Senator Cohen, Senator Shoemaker, that actually is not, as I recollect at the moment, a defined term in the federal statute. That language was drawn from the federal statute and intended to track exactly the federal statute. I believe that that car phone transmissions fall within the definition of electronic communications and so could not be intercepted without a wiretap order. The private land mobile communications, I believe, is a term of art which refers to specialty communications like business radio systems for sand and gravel companies and that kind of thing.
But is it defined? Is it a word of art within Oregon law?
No, Senator, it is not, and it's not, to my best recollection, not defined in the federal law either.
So we don't really know what it is.
Senator Cohen, Senator Shoemaker, I believe that's correct.
So under this bill, if enacted, you would not need any order in order to intercept any communication from a private land mobile system, whatever that might be.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, I believe that's correct. And as I say, the intent of that was to cover, I believe, the kind of communications that take place with regular business transmissions, and it would not extend to mobile car telephones.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Not unless there are any other questions.
Is there anything they've missed? I mean, other than putting some kind of electronic transmitter inside your brain? It looks like you guys kind of pick up everything here, don't you, whether it's been invented or not?
Or Senator Cohen, if that's a question that...
I'm sorry. No, it was rhetorical. I appreciate the written material you provided. That was very helpful. And we know that the feds have obviously made their statement in terms of what privacy is or is not. And I guess it's our turn now. But your exposition was very helpful. I know there's been a lot of change in that area. And
I know it presents a practical problem to law enforcement when the feds and the state are kind of operating, pardon the expression, on a different wavelength here.
Madam Chair,
Senator.
Why would you want to use these things in cases that weren't involving felonies?
Senator, it really was an artifact of the drafting process. It was, from my standpoint, if the committee wished to limit it to drug, to felonies, I'd have no objection. It was simpler, it seemed to me, to designate the statutes that defined all controlled substance violations as a drafting matter than it was to try and parse out from those statutes the many variations and permutations which define what a felony drug offense was. But I have no objection if the committee wishes to change that.
I'm sure, because some of these things, I mean, for example, the mobile tracking device, I don't know if I see that as much of an intrusion, but the phone calls, recording everybody's phone calls regardless, in a way, some of this is a, well, I have less comfort with this in a way than any of the other bills that we've discussed, I must say. This one, everything is going kind of smoothly, and suddenly this thing is fairly bothersome. Maybe it's because of the, it covers a range of devices. The mobile tracking devices, they don't have much problem with, but the others, I have to say, it's sort of the kind of a, sort of a dragnet kind of a thing with the device for the phone calls coming in and out and those kind of things. So that some you, well, thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions from committee members? Dale?
My name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association in support of 2469. Much of this was in response to Senator Springer's invitation, actually, during the interim committee, that we needed to draft some bill to deal with the federal law changes in the area of electronic communications. I would simply state that the trap and trace device and the PIN register are areas that were utilized in law enforcement up until this October. They were used primarily in narcotics cases, and it's very similar to sitting outside someone's house and putting down the license.